Hey besties, welcome back or welcome to the 20-something Teenage Girl Podcast. I am your host, Marin, and on today's episode, we will be doing a deep dive into Ethel Cain's album, Preacher's Daughter. Before I begin, I do have to issue a slew of trigger warnings, so if you do not want to hear about religious trauma, generational trauma, sexual or physical violence, I highly recommend that you turn this video off right now. Girl, trust me, I get it. Go watch something happy. Go watch Wizards of Waverly Place. I heard they're doing a reboot soon. What?
The idea for this episode actually came to me because I was watching Brittany Broski's podcast, and she fucking slays, but that's a whole other thing. She did this episode called Why I Left the Christian Church. And I was like, oh my God, girl, same. I left the Mormon church. Let's talk. And in the episode, she talks about this album called Preacher's Daughter by the artist Ethel Cain. And I had listened to like a song or two on the album. It was popular on TikTok a while back, but I had never sat down and listened to the album start to finish. And oh my fucking God, besties, it is so fucking good. It is the piece of art that I have been looking for since I was a young girl. So thank you, Brittany, for introducing wonderful music to me. If you haven't listened to her podcast for some reason, I would recommend it. It's so fucking funny. She's so intelligent. I'm in love with her. But anyways, so I wanted to talk about this album because, as I formally mentioned, I did grow up in the Mormon church, and this album is very centered around religious trauma, generational trauma, specifically the journey of losing one's faith and navigating the world after coping with both religious and generational trauma and some of the consequences of that. Really, it's about the cycle of abuse. And as I mentioned before, it's going to be a very heavy conversation. I may make inappropriate jokes, and for that, I'm sorry. I'm just uncomfortable because this shit is a little too real for me. So before I begin, I want to talk a little bit about Ethel Cain's background. So Ethel Cain is actually a stage name. The real artist's name is Hayden Anhedonia. I think that's how you say her last name. It is gorgeous. Oh my God. So Hayden grew up in this town called Perry in Florida in the South Baptist Church. And Hayden is a transgender woman. And if you don't already know, the South Baptist Church and a lot of Christian denominations are still extremely heteronormative, patriarchal, and super segregated. And I can only imagine the internal conflict that Hayden must have felt growing up in an environment that would have never accepted her for who she was. So Hayden found her love for music by joining the church choir when she was young. Very similar to me. I joined the Mormon choir when I was a young girl. And she decided to leave the church and leave the town after she came out to her family. She was ostracized from the entire community. And she says after that, she, quote, found herself possessed by a woman named Ethel Cain, end quote. As I mentioned earlier, Ethel Cain is a stage name and is also the name for this character who we follow throughout the course of Preacher's Daughter. Preacher's Daughter is something we call a concept album, and concept albums can have many different meanings, many different stories or themes. The way that Preacher's Daughter works is it is the story it is the coming of age story of a young woman named Ethel Cain. I couldn't find if this story is at all biographical, but seeing how a lot of the elements kind of align with Ethel's upbringing, I would assume that it is autobiographical, but at the same time, obviously dramatized. I also just want to say another disclaimer. I feel like a lot of people have this mindset nowadays where we don't let people interpret art anymore the way that they want to interpret it. I was in an English class this past year, and we were talking about this book, and my teacher asked everybody to share their interpretations of a particular passage. And this girl raises her hand, and she goes, "I don't know if this is right, but," and my professor says, "I'm going to stop you right there," cuts her off, and goes on to tell her that we are all human beings with very different experiences, very different backgrounds. And the beauty in that is no two people are ever going to read a passage the same way. We will all interpret music, art, film differently. And I think that this is wonderful. So I just want to mention that a lot of the things I'm going to be saying today are my own interpretations. A lot of what I'm going to say is also from other people's interpretations. I scoured the internet. I scoured Reddit. Any other sources that I used will be linked down below if you want to check those out. And without further ado, let's just hop right into it. So this album opens up with the first track called Family Tree. Another thing that Ethel does is she uses sound to tell the story. Not only with her lyrics, but the first song, for example, her vocals have an echo, and it sounds almost like she's singing this first song in a church. There is also church bells ringing in the background. The song opens with a distorted voice of her father, the preacher, leading a sermon. And right away, she kind of introduces the theme of this story. And to me, that theme is the female experience in evangelist Christian traditions and the cycle of abuse that often happens in religious families, and how so much of that abuse is directed towards the women. So this opens up with a mother is a very special thing. And other than the Lord Jesus Christ, I think that a mother is one of the most precious gifts that God gives to this world, because the mother is the one who loves the Lord and always seems to be there when we need her. A mother is a very special thing. Oh, is that her dad saying that? That's very interesting. So I think that that first passage that I just read is actually the preacher, her father, telling the rest of the church this, which is very, very fascinating. So she goes on to say, "These crosses all over my body remind me of who I used to be. And Christ forgive these bones I'm hiding." So this line, "and Christ forgive these bones I'm hiding," really stand out to me. So Hayden and Adonia, the writer of this, is a transgender woman. It hasn't been confirmed or denied whether or not Ethel Kane, the character of this album, is transgender. However, it is kind of clear to me with this line, because she is saying, "Forgive these bones I'm hiding. Forgive who I am," because who she is, according to her religion, is sinful. It goes on to say, "Jesus can always reject his father, but he cannot escape his mother's blood." And holy fucking shit, do I even need to elaborate on that? He'll scream and try to wash it off his fingers, but he'll never escape what he's made up of. I think pointing to how a lot of men get to where they are, leaving a lot of women in their path. So it finishes by saying, "The fates already fucked me sideways, swinging by my neck from the family tree. He'll laugh and say, 'You know I raised you better than this,' then leave me hanging so they can all laugh at me." So I think that this part is pointing to the trauma and the abuse that she experienced from her father, who was the preacher, someone who many people looked up to in the community. And I think it's really interesting. She uses this symbol of the noose as being something that connects her to the family tree. She's not a part of the family tree. She's hanging from this tree. And I think that this is a perfect, beautiful analogy to how generational trauma is passed down from father to son, mother to daughter, and always kind of ends up affecting the children more than the parents. And this line, "the fates already fucked me sideways," I think just reiterates this because she's born into this. So then we go into the second track, which is called "American Teenager." And this is kind of an ode to the American teenage experience. And I found myself relating my high school and teenage experience to this song quite a lot. She talks about how she is kind of shifting her idea of the divine from God or Jesus to these football games. She really idolizes the popular people at her school, I think, as all of us do. If you did grow up in a church, you probably can relate to this. Being told that certain things are very important, certain things you need to steer clear of. But then you enter high school, you start kind of thinking for yourself, you start mingling with people that maybe aren't from the same religion as you, and you start to wonder, well, why am I not allowed to have fun? So a lot of people say that this is also an anti-war anthem, and I agree with this. There is a line that says, "the neighbor's brother came home in a box, but he wanted to go. Maybe it was his fault." It also carries on with the theme of parental abuse and generational trauma. My favorite line from this song comes from the chorus, and it says, "say what you want, but say it like you mean it with your fists for once. A long cold war with your kids at the front." That one in particularly, "a long cold war with your kids at the front," is, I don't want to talk about that. That's a little too real for me, Ethel. Okay. But I think what she's doing here is kind of comparing the kids that get sent off to war to the kids that are growing up in abusive households. I think a lot of people look at America as this like patriarchal figure. I mean, Uncle Sam is a thing, especially during this time period. I like to think of this all taking place in the 80s. I'm not entirely sure when it's supposed to take place, but I think it's very interesting to compare war to abuse, because I'm sure anybody that has grown up in a household like this, it can often feel like you are at the front of the war, of the battlefield, a battle that you didn't even sign up to fight in the first place. She also talks about how she begins to use alcohol as a coping mechanism for what she's dealing with. There's a line that says, "Jesus, if you're listening, let me handle my liquor. And Jesus, if you're there, why do I feel so alone in this room with you?" So she's kind of starting to pull away from church and obviously starting to get into partying, into drinking, into normal teenage things. But she's also starting to question her faith. So the next song is called "House in Nebraska," and this is, in my opinion, her reminiscing on her high school boyfriend. I couldn't figure out if her high school boyfriend just broke up with her or passed away, but there's a line where she says, something along the lines of, "I can't believe I'm the reason that you won't come home." So that leads me to believe that this was a breakup that went bad. But she talks about this house in Nebraska that either they met up in or dreamed of inhabiting one day. So Ethel Cain says in an interview, quote, "I saw Nebraska as the center of America. It was this empty place I could imagine myself running away to someday, being completely alone with the love of my life forever. It's heaven on earth. You'll never be bothered again." Oh, I think when you lose your faith, you really lose your community and you truly just want to run away and go to where you don't know who anybody is. I think it's very interesting that she chooses Nebraska, this place in the middle of nowhere that a lot of people wouldn't want to live. But I also resonate to this because I feel like I grew up in neighborhoods where houses were very close together. I knew all my neighbors. I couldn't go for a walk without having to talk to all of these people that I didn't really want to talk to. So it is also a dream of mine to move to the middle of nowhere with my husband. So Ethel girl, I get it. I think that this song is just hauntingly beautiful and perfectly encaptures what it feels like to lose someone who you thought was going to be your escape, who you thought was going to be the love of your life. So another thing that I think is really interesting about this song is I think that she is actually talking about the loss of her virginity with this lover. So if you didn't already know, in the Baptist tradition, as well as the Mormon tradition, sex before marriage is no, not allowed. But as we all know, when you fall in love with a person, girl, that's the first thing you're going to want to do. So there's this line that says, where you, she's talking about the house, and she says, where you told me that even if we died tonight, I die yours. So I died there under you every night, all night. This use of the word die kind of makes me think that she is talking about losing her virginity, because both are an end. In the church, it's like when you lose your virginity, that is the end of your purity. That is the end of your worth as a woman. It is something that you can never get back and is something that you are supposed to save for your husband. So the fact that she is giving this away to him before even getting married to him very much probably feels like a death to her. She is giving away something that she is not yet supposed to give away and is something that she can never take back. Just a side note though, virginity is a construct, okay? But we can talk about that in another video. And this is further solidified for me with the line, so I died there under you every night. Under you, do you get it? Because sex. There's like a very intense reverb in a lot of her songs, but especially in this song. And I think that that is like a sonic metaphor for how these past relationships, especially with like that one, you know who I'm talking about, will just continue to haunt you for the rest of your life. This is a song that is just entirely about reminiscing over what could have been. And oftentimes those particular thoughts that we have are so repetitive and so constant that it can feel like it's inescapable, like it's out of our control. And I think that this song just does such a beautiful job at capturing, both with the lyrics and with the sound, exactly how it feels to lose someone who you thought you were going to be with forever. And I think it also perfectly captures the feeling of not only losing someone who you thought was going to be with you forever, losing somebody that you kind of made a commitment to, because not only has she given this boy her virginity, she has planned where they're going to live. She has already agreed to leave behind everything she knows. So with the loss of this man comes the loss of a life. And I think that might be another reason why she uses the word death in here. But anyways, moving on. So the next song is called Western Nights, and this details her getting into a relationship with an abusive man that she meets either in a bar or on the side of the road. This man is a baddie. He is a bad boy. He likes to steal from ATMs, and he likes to have tattoos and ride his motorcycle. Basically the opposite of everything that she was probably taught that she should look for in a man. And I think a lot of us, ex-Christian, ex-Mormon, whatever, I think this is something a lot of us can relate to, because I know for a fact, once I decided to leave the Mormon church, I just wanted to not hang out with anybody that subscribed to that religion. I found a boyfriend that was like the furthest thing from anyone that I had dated in the past. But unfortunately, because she's lost her family and her community and her faith, three things that all of us attach our identities and sense of self to, she is desperately trying to attach her sense of self to a man. It doesn't matter what he does to her. And in fact, the fact that she grew up in an abusive household, that kind of love is the only love that she knows. So this song is very telling on how generational trauma can, and the cycle of abuse continues, because when we are shown that love is abusive, we will only think of love as something that is abusive. And that is just not what that is. But when you don't have any other examples in your life, how are you supposed to know any better? So I think at the end of this song, her boyfriend gets shot and killed by the police during a robbery. And this kind of causes her to spiral back down into a depression. And this is where we get the full song of Family Tree. I think that the death of this boyfriend forces her to look at her past, look at her trauma. Why did she select somebody like him in the first place? So in the first Family Tree, in the introduction, there is the line that reads, "Swinging by my neck from the family tree." Now she sings, "Take the noose off, wrap it tight around my hand." So I think that she is kind of, okay, two things that this could mean. Number one, I think that she is trying to distance herself from her family, but she's still attached. It's still on her hand. Number two, I think that she might be referencing like a wedding band. So this might be turning that family trauma into romantic trauma with romantic partners. So she says again the line, "Let Christ forgive these bones I've been hiding and the bones I'm about to leave." So two things. If we're looking at this as an interpretation, as a metaphor for being transgender, I think that this is her finally coming into herself as a woman, leaving behind her former self. I also think that this is quite literal, talking about her boyfriend who I think she married him. So her dead husband who has been killed in the robbery, she is leaving behind his bones. And I think that in this line, she is kind of asking God to forgive her for the crimes that she committed with her dead husband. So there's also a little theory that I saw somebody share on Reddit that Ethel Cain kills her father. I forgot to mention this earlier, but I believe either in the Family Tree intro or in American Teenager, it's mentioned that Ethel Cain's father died in a house fire. So there's a few reasons why people think that Ethel Cain killed her father. So she's reminiscing on her childhood, and this is where this is going to get probably very triggering for some of you. So I will put a timestamp to when I am done talking about this. So if you want to skip ahead, you can. So this song opens with the same line from the first song. "These crosses all over my body remind me of who I used to be." And then it goes on to talk about, I think, her relationship with her father. So this song makes it very clear to us that her father was sexually molesting her as a child. It says, "Give myself up to him in offering, let him make a woman out of me. I'm just a child, but I'm not above violence." These first two lines, "Give myself up to him in offering, let him make a woman out of me," make me believe that that was the type of abuse that she was withstanding from her father. And that last line, "I'm just a child, but I'm not above violence," solidifies the fact that she probably killed her father. There's also a line that says, "I've killed before and I'll kill again." So I don't think she can get much clearer than that. Another one of my favorite lines, she says, "They say heaven hath no fury like a woman scorned. And baby, hell don't scare me. I've been times before." Talking about how women in general, a lot of us are told that we're not allowed to be angry. Being angry, being vengeful or resentful are not emotions that we're supposed to feel or express. And what ends up happening, at least for me, is when you bottle up all of this anger, oh my God, this is a turn into a fucking hellstorm. And I think this line, "They say heaven hath no fury like a woman scorned," is from the Bible or something else. Somebody let me know down below. But I just love this line because it is so fucking true, bitch. You do not want to fuck with a woman. We have years worth up, built up of pent up rage that we are just waiting to release on the nearest target. So try me, okay? Okay. And I love that she says, "Baby, hell don't scare me. I've been times before." Her life, her childhood was hell, was probably the most traumatic, that it fucking gets. And because she has already experienced the worst of the worst, many people's greatest fears, she's not even scared of hell anymore. This whole idea of heaven and hell has basically lost all meaning to her because the house that she grew up in quite literally was hell. I think that she confirms this by talking about burning down her childhood house. Hell, fire. She talks constantly about being taken down to the river and getting bathed clean. So there is a running theme in purity in general, especially when it comes to women. We are supposed to be pure. We're supposed to be reverent. We're supposed to be obedient. She says, "Put me on the back of your white horse to ride all the way to the chapel. Let you wash all over me." So talking about how I think, first of all, "let me get on the back of your white horse" to me is very reminiscent of the damsel in distress archetype that we see in a lot of literature and movies. We are taught as women that we can only be saved by a man. And she has this ideology. She brings this with her that has been forced onto her by trauma. And she has been taught that only by going to the chapel, which is the source of her trauma, her father, who is the source of her trauma, leads that church. She is taught that that is the only way she can be clean. And, oh my God, girl, oh, I'm so sorry. I also think that she could be maybe wanting to revert back to her faith a little bit after losing her husband. One of the greatest comforts that being religious brought to me for many years was the idea of heaven, the idea of the eternal family, and I think that this is a beautiful idea. I still don't reject this idea, but once I lost that confirmation that anyone who left me on earth, I wasn't sure if I would ever get to see them again. That is a very scary thought to possess. And I think that that is why a lot of people turn to religion in their grief. And I think that Ethel's grief is almost kind of causing a bit of a resurgence, not just of her childhood memories, but almost wanting to return to the chapel to be bathed clean, to repent for her sins. So the next song, Hard Times, really dives into the story and abuse that she suffered at the hands of her father, and how even after all of that, she still feels attached to them. She says throughout the story, "I'm tired of you still tied to me." I think this is going back to the noose reference. I think that her taking off the noose and putting it back on her hand is her still being tied to her father, tied to her family. This song is just like gut-wrenching, and I actually have a really hard time listening to it. There are many beautiful and just like heartbreaking lines. I will read a few for you now. "I thought good guys get to be happy. I'm not happy. I am poison in the water and unhappy. Little girl who needs her daddy real bad in the corner." Ugh, I can't. I'm gonna cry. So this is where it gets like fucking just really fucked up. So again, trigger warning. It says, "In the corner on my birthday, you watched me dancing right there in the grass. I was too young to notice that some types of love could be bad." Oh my God. "Praying I'd be like you, doing all the things that you do, and I still do, and that scares me." Ugh, I'm crying now. I don't care. I'll cry. I'll do it again. So, oh my fucking God. I think that this verse really speaks to itself. The line from here that I think is so hauntingly beautiful and important is, "I was too young to notice that some types of love could be bad." I think that when you are a little girl, you have not yet been told that men view you as a sexual object a lot of the times. And you especially wouldn't expect somebody that is supposed to keep you safe, that is supposed to love you in a healthy platonic way. You don't expect the people that you love to hurt you. And unfortunately, as so many girlies probably experience, and just so many people in general, a lot of the times it is... I was about to quote Hunger Games, but true, it is the things we love most that destroy us. And this thought that she keeps saying over and over again of even through, oh God, I just keep this song. You understand why I can't listen to the song. Even after everything that her dad has put her through, she still loves him. She still wants to be like him. Like, we all just want to be like our dads. Little girls, like, oh my God, okay, I'm going to stop because I'm going to cry. I think that something that's very interesting here is the irony of her dad, who is the biggest villain in this story, being a preacher, being a renowned member of the community. And this is something that reminds me of the state of the Mormon church today. So in my experience there were many instances with myself and with people that I knew where men in the church that were supposed to protect us would be the ones sexualizing us. And even still to this day, the church continues to protect people that absolutely do not fucking deserve protecting. So the church has set up this abuse reporting line that when you call the number, you are redirected to the church's lawyers. I have never called this line. I don't know anybody that has, so I'm really just speculating. But I can only imagine, since they are using their own lawyers, that many of these cases go without notice. The Mormon church is, I'm fucking scared to say this because I have a lot of family members and friends that are still members of the church, and two things can be true at once. You can be Mormon and also not be a part of any of the horrifying things that tend to happen. But at the same time, I do think that it is so important to talk about this, to call out this behavior, especially in religious organizations. It's not even just the Mormon church, the Catholic church, to name one. There are a lot of instances throughout history of religious leaders abusing young people and children. And I think in every fucking way, shape, or form, in any way possible that you have, stand the fuck up against that shit. And I feel like this should be common sense. I don't even know why I'm scared to talk about it, because I feel like this is common fucking sense. And it breaks my heart and it makes me sick to my stomach. And when we're talking about generational abuse and generational trauma in the church, if we look at the origins of the church, which I'm thinking of just doing an entire video talking about the history because it is fucking insane. The Mormon church is built on the graves of so many people. There were so many instances of horrifying violence that were involved in the founding of this religion. And I think that it is very, very important to look at history, one, so that it doesn't repeat itself, and two, because history shapes the way that people look at things in the world today. It shapes our institutions. I think it is so fucking important to talk about American history, not just the bits that were in our high school textbook. The fucking horrific things that haven't been talked about or brought to light. I think it is important that we continue to have uncomfortable conversations about things that certain institutions participated in, whether that was the American government or the Mormon church. We have to bring that up so that we don't repeat the mistakes, and that any of those mistakes that are being made today can be corrected. But anyways, sorry, that was like a little bit of a tangent. I just feel like that needed to be said, and I don't even know if I said it in the way that I want to say it. There's so much that I wish I could do, but I don't know. I feel so powerless in the face of these giant institutions sometimes, and I'm even fucking scared of saying this now. So great. That's great. Okay, let's continue. So the next song in this album is called Thoroughfare, and this is where she meets her final love interest, and his name is Isaiah. I know that Isaiah is a prophet, I believe, in the Bible. I tried to look up his story, and girl, it was too complex for me. So if any of you have an interpretation of that name, or know its significance. I think that that would be really interesting. Ethel, Hayden and Adonia is too smart for me. I don't even know, like, there's so much in here that I would probably never find, because holy fucking shit, this girl is so intelligent. So this story is very much a love story. It's very sweet. It's very happy. It talks about the beginnings of her relationship with Isaiah. She meets him in Texas somewhere on the thoroughfare, which, is that a highway? Somebody let me know. Oh, yeah. Okay, because it says on the side of the road in some torn up clothes with a pistol in my pocket. So we can only assume that this is taking place right after her husband has been killed. And I think that she is trying to get away. And so she's hitchhiking. And this is when she's picked up by Isaiah. It goes on to say, so I hopped right in out of luck to spend, and at least your truck beats walking. And you said, hey, do you want to see the West with me? Because love's out there and I can't leave it be. And I said, honey, love's never meant much to me, but I'll come with you if you're sure it's what you need. So we made off for California to find your lover driving day and night. And every small town diner saw our faces at least once or twice. But in these motel rooms, I started to see you differently, because for the first time since I was a child, I could see a man who wasn't angry. Oh my God. If you are someone who has been surrounded by the rage of men for your entire life, and I do think that, unfortunately, most of the straight cis men that I come across are very angry people, because as we mentioned earlier, anger isn't really an acceptable emotion for feminine people to display. However, for people that are more masculine, this is totally fine for some reason. But anyways, saying that for the first time since she was a child, she sees a man that wasn't angry, like, it's no wonder that she falls in love with him. She gets attached to him. It seems like what Isaiah is presenting at first is very much the opposite of her father. So it seems like things are looking up. Like, she has finally met a good man. She is leaving Florida. She's going to California. What's also really interesting about this is the sound, of course. So she uses guitar strums and harmonica notes, and to me this sounds very reminiscent of like southwestern bars, so really encompassing that idea of like the old West and California being kind of like the golden state. The West has always kind of been looked at as the epitome of the American dream. And she is like very much romanticizing both this relationship with this man and the West in general in this song. And I think that that is beautiful, ingenious, and insane. So the next song, Gibson Girl, complete change of mood. This song is also so fucking sexy. Like, okay, girl, I see you. There are a few different interpretations that I found online. To me, I think that Isaiah is the owner of a strip club and forces Ethel to strip at the club and kind of takes ownership of her in that way. And I also think that she starts to get into a lot of hard drugs. This is mentioned in the lyrics. So yeah, we can assume that in this song particularly, she is essentially in a different state consciously. And the sound of this song sounds like if I could make a song that sounded like how it feels to feel really sexy and be really drunk in a club somewhere in LA, this is exactly the instrumental that I would give you. It's gorgeous, it's amazing. And again, her ability to put different stories into just sound is nuts. We need to fix this. Okay, lipstick break. How about some girl talk, okay? Let's like fucking stop talking about trauma for a second, because, babe, wait, I can't talk and do this at the same time. How are you doing, girl? How's the partner? How's the love interest? How are your friends? Are they treating you nicely?
did you drink any water today? Did you eat? Did you eat a vegetable? Did you eat a fruit? did you do something nice for yourself today? Like go for a walk or take a nice shower or just like give yourself a little face mask or something?
This song to me is also kind of like her sexual awakening. So we get a little bit about sex in House in Nebraska, but this song is really sexual. She is, in a sense, exploring her sexuality. And I think it talks a lot about like the fine line between sex and violence when you grow up without ever believing that you would even have sex with anyone other than your husband. When you do start to have sex, it can be very confusing because, first of all, it is we are taught that it is supposed to only be for making children. So when you start to explore that, it's difficult to discern the difference between healthy positive sex and unhealthy sex. It opens up by saying, "You want to get my clothes off and hurt me." There is another line that says, "Obsession with the money, addicted to the drugs, says he's in love with my body, that's why he's fucking it up." Abusive men, a lot of the times they will use love to justify what they are doing. There is another line that says, "Baby, if it feels good, then it can't be bad." And again, this is kind of Ethel, in a way you can tell that maybe she knows deep down that this isn't how sex is probably supposed to be. So the next track in this album is my favorite, and it is also the heaviest track and is probably going to make me cry again. And this song is called Ptolemaia. So Ptolemaia was named after the ninth circle of hell in Dante's Inferno. The ninth circle of hell is like, I believe, the lowest, and it's freezing. So it's so far away from everything that it is literally a wasteland. And this is saved for people that betray their friends and their family. So in at least this interpretation, betrayal is the worst form of sin. Keep this in mind. So the song opens up with this very distorted voice that I believe is Isaiah, her boyfriend, talking to her. And it opens up by saying, "I followed you in and I was with you there. I invited you in twice. I did. You love blood too much, but not like I do. Not like I do." So what I think this is Isaiah plotting this kind of capture almost of Ethel. He talks about how he kind of followed her, which is to me reminiscent of how a lot of abusive men will get into relationships by like love bombing, by being very sweet and wonderful at the beginning and turning in 1 second. The last few lines of this really stand out to me too. "You love blood too much, but not like I do." So again, to me, this confirms that Ethel again did probably murder her father. Him saying, "But not like I do, not like I do." He says it twice. Isaiah is someone that is genuinely a murderous person. Ethel Cain is not murderous. She murdered out of necessity and out of rage, which I fucking get it, girl. I would have let that house on fire too. So then Ethel comes in and she starts singing, "Suffered as the wolf crawling to thee, promising a big fire, any fire, saying I'm the one, he's gonna take me. I'm on fire, I'm on fire, I'm on fire. Suffering is nigh, drawing to me, calling me the one, I'm the white light, beautiful, finite." So I think she is referring to Isaiah, calling him a wolf, and promising a big fire, any fire, is again, I believe, her talking about the manipulation tactics that Isaiah used to lure her in. And this is solidified by the last few lines, "Calling me the one, I'm the white light, beautiful, finite." Again, how a lot of men will use flattery to get their way, to take advantage of people. Then it goes on to say, "Even the iron still fears the rot, hiding from something I cannot stop, walking on shadows, I can't lead him back, buckled on the floor when night comes along, daddy's left and mama won't come home." So, oh my god, don't cry again. I'm probably gonna cry. So the first two lines, "Even the iron still fears the rot, hiding from something I cannot stop," to me is her knowing that she is going to die, but also knowing that she can no longer escape Isaiah, whether that is because she is just so far gone into this relationship or so far gone from the drugs, I'm not sure. Then it talks about how she is beginning to yearn for her father and her mother. You just want your mom and dad sometimes, girl. And like, I absolutely get that. So then it goes back to Isaiah's voice, and this fucking section says, "You." It's so fucking creepy. It says, "You poor thing, sweet morning lamb, there's nothing you can do. It's already been done." So the Bible uses this analogy of Christ as a shepherd and us being God's children as his flock, so kind of guiding us. So I think that that's what she's saying here when it says, "You poor thing, sweet morning lamb." Lambs are also very innocent. The church tends to view women as innocent and pure, as I've mentioned a few times before. And the last two lines, "There's nothing you can do, it's already been done," I think call back to the generational trauma, how it's almost been prophesized. So then it goes back to Ethel, and it says, "What fear a man like you brings upon a woman like me." And there is a little sidebar of Isaiah saying, "Show me your face." It goes on to say, "Please don't look at me. I can see it in your eyes. He keeps looking at me. Tell me, what have you done?" So again, just reiterating the fact that I think she knows that her death is coming. And this fucking... Okay, so this is where I'm going to need you to maybe pause and just go listen to this. I believe that this is the part where Isaiah murders her, because she says, "Stop, stop, stop, make it stop, stop, make it stop. I've had enough. Stop, 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 stop." And then she screams, "Stop." And it is, get this girl in a fucking horror movie, because it is the most blood-curdling, bone-chilling scream. And it, like, just that, oh my God, it just makes me want to cry. And a lot of people say that this isn't the point in time where she is killed, but I think that there is no other point in the album that would make sense. I think that this is her final word on earth. Then it goes into this very like reverberated sound of her voice, and she's saying over and over again, "I am the face of love's rage." And that line, oh my God, holy fucking shit. I'm just never gonna write a word again, because when Ethel Cain is writing, like, is there a reason to write? I don't think so. So this is when it's gonna get biblical, okay? Hang on. So then it goes back to this distorted demon voice, and I have a hard time deciding if this is the voice of Isaiah or death, and you'll see what I mean. As it goes on, it is definitely the voice of death. So I'm just going to assume that this is the voice of death, because Ethel has now been murdered. "Blessed be the daughters of Cain, bound to suffering eternal through the sins of their fathers committed long before their conception." So if you don't already know the story of Cain and Abel, Cain and Abel were the first children of Adam and Eve, who were the first humans on earth. And Cain and Abel were instructed to bring sacrifices to God. I forget what both of them bring. I believe that Abel brings a lamb, and I believe that Cain brings agriculture. Somebody please correct me if I'm wrong. And God accepts Abel's sacrifice, but doesn't accept Cain's sacrifice. This kind of prompts him into a murderous rage. When I was looking at the different translations of the Bible and different people's interpretations of this, this entire section gets muddled, because we know that Cain and Abel have a conversation before Cain kills Abel, but I believe that that conversation has been removed from every text. So it is hard to note the motivations behind Cain's murdering of his brother, but most people assume that it was murder out of jealousy, or it was his interpretation that God wanted a bigger sacrifice and that Abel might have been the sacrifice. And I think, again, going back to the first part of the song when Isaiah calls her sweet morning lamb, is Ethel the sacrifice? Is Ethel a sacrifice? What are we talking about? What are we are we foreshadowing how she's going to be murdered? I don't know. She's too smart for me. So I'm just going to go off of the fact that Cain murders his brother out of anger. And this is where the story gets extremely fascinating to me. And I'm going to kind of get sidetracked a little bit here, but I think that theology is actually very fascinating. So if you don't, sorry. So in order to punish Cain for murdering his brother, he is ostracized from his family and he has to leave. So the Lord bestows this mark upon Cain as a punishment and says, quote, "Go through the city, through Jerusalem, and put a mark upon the foreheads of the men who sigh and groan all over the abominations that are committed in it," end quote. But I don't think that God completely abandons Cain, because it also mentions, quote, "If anyone slays Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold," end quote. So in the original interpretation that I was taught of the story of Cain and Abel, in the Mormon church, we are taught that once Cain murdered his brother, that the mark of Cain was actually the mark of darker skin. So this would support the Mormon, and I believe in many Christian churches. It's definitely not all of them, but the Western Christian idea is that Adam and Eve were white, and so Cain and Abel were white, and that God gave Cain this mark to darken his skin as a punishment, which, like, girl, I don't get it. But anyways, I searched through every different translation that I could find. There is not one scripture, both in the Mormon version of the Bible and the other versions, that says that Cain's skin was ever darkened. This particular Bible story was quoted often to justify slavery. So in African American Christian churches, when Cain commits this crime, his skin is turned white because he becomes white with fright over the fear of God's punishment. So there's this quote from James Baldwin that reads, quote, "In the same way that we, for white people, were the descendants of Ham and were cursed forever, white people were for us the descendants of Cain." In this version, Cain was ostracized to Europe. So this is used to describe and explain imperialism and colonialism and the amount of death and violence that was a product of European imperialism. So to be quite honest with you, this second version to me sounds a lot more accurate, if any of these versions are. And again, this is never mentioned in any translation of the Bible that we have. Cain is the first murderer, and Ethel in this story is murdered. So I think that this quote that she mentions, "Blessed be the daughters of Cain, bound to suffering eternal through the sins of their fathers committed long before their conception," really rings true again to generational trauma, how this children of people that have experienced trauma often end up experiencing that trauma themselves. And I think using Cain as an analogy for this is absolutely brilliant. And again, she is too smart for me. So it goes on to say, "Blessed be their whoremothers, tired and angry, waiting with bated breath in a ferry that will never move again. Blessed be the children, each and every one come to know their God through some senseless act of violence." Oh my God. "Blessed be you, girl, promised to me by a man who can only feel hatred and contempt towards you." So this is definitely death talking here. This line, "Blessed be the children, each and every one come to know their God through some senseless act of violence." Did I just almost say bars? No, that's not funny. I can't make a joke about that. That is just, do I need to elaborate? No. Oh my God. Ethel. Oh my God. So at this point in time, it's very clear that death is who is speaking to us, because he mentions, "Blessed be you, girl, promised to me by a man who can only feel hatred and contempt to you." So she is promised to death by Isaiah. And it goes on to say, "I am not good nor evil. Simply I am, and I have come to take what is mine. I was there in the dark when you spilled your first blood. I am here now as you run from me still. Run then, child. You can't hide from me forever." So this line is very interesting to me. "I was there in the dark when you spilled your first blood." So for me, this could mean two things. The first thing that I think this could be referring to is the potential murder of Ethel Kane's father. So death was there in the dark when she spilled her first blood, when she first murdered her father. Or I think that this could be talking about her period. This idea of the period is like very simultaneous with the idea of womanhood. Once you get your period in history, a lot of the times that was when you were old enough to get married. And this is a very disgusting way to look at womanhood, to look at adulthood. I think that we have always looked at women as being more mature than men, but this comes to a fault because when you get your period, you are 10, 12, 13. I think I was 13. You still are very much a child. So I think that he is kind of talking about her spilling her first blood when she first became a woman. Or I think that this is kind of just talking about how periods are seen as very unclean. They are just not spoken about, at least in my religious upbringing. We often look at women's blood as this disgusting thing that is unclean and unpure, when it has literally been a natural part of our existence since the beginning of time. And the end, "I'm here now as you run from me still. Run then, child. You can't hide from me forever," just solidifies again that like she has been killed in this song. The next song, August Underground, is like a very angry sounding instrumental song that just sounds like hopeless rage. Something that I think is very interesting, the name August Underground comes from a horror, I believe it's either a franchise or one film, but it was banned, and don't even fucking look it up. It's fucking disgusting. But it is about this serial killer that does very horrifying, evil things to his victims, and there's a reason why it was banned. So I think that this again is just Ethel Kane explaining the origins of her death, like just absolutely worst case scenario. The next song, Televangelism, is also an instrumental, but it does sound a little bit more hopeful. It's piano, and to me, it really sounds like her acceptance of her death, her letting go of this rage, and it sounds like somebody ascending to heaven to me. So televangelism is an interesting name because televangelism refers to religious evangelist TV programs that were very popular around the 80s and 90s. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, have you seen that clip of the preacher being like, "Why? Why?" So there were like fucking Christian preachers, I guess, that used to go on and preach online. And I think, I don't really know what to make of this. If somebody has like an interpretation of maybe the connection between televangelism and what this song is supposed to represent, that would be really interesting. But I just thought that that was an interesting fact. And I still haven't really been able to tie the connection together. But anyways. So the next song is called Sun-Bleached Flies, and this song to me is all about her forgiveness, acceptance, and understanding of those that hurt her. She understands that the people that traumatized her were traumatized themselves, and this allows her to forgive them and let go of all of the rage that she has been feeling her entire life. And it also really represents her acceptance of her death. So forgiveness, is a central Christian value and was a central value that I was taught growing up in the Mormon church that I think is extremely important to hold on to, because you can forgive, but you don't have to forget. You can also forgive people and not let them back into your life. You can forgive people and still hold them accountable, but it is important to forgive nonetheless, because, girl, I promise you, if you continue to hold on to that anger, you will really hurt yourself. That is not your anger to hold on to. And trust me, they will get their motherfucking karma. That is not up to you. So one interesting line from this is, God loves you, but not enough to save you. And to me, this rings true to like this kind of existential issue. I'm going to quote Beef, which if you haven't seen it, it's a Netflix show. It's fucking insane. There's this point in the show where the two main characters are talking about God, and one of the characters says, "That's why I don't believe in God. If there was a God, why would he make it like this?" And I think this is kind of reminiscent of the line that Ethel is saying here, God loves you, but not enough to save you. It's difficult to be told that God is this thing of love and light and joy when, and that God is everything. But at the same time, if God is everything, then how does he allow so much suffering? And this has been an issue in theology that has been debated for hundreds of years, and I'm not up to debate that, but anyways. So it goes on to say, I always knew that in the end no one was coming to save me, so I just prayed and I kept on praying and praying. If it's meant to be, then it will be. So I met him and told him, I believe. I forgive it all as it all comes back to me. If it's meant to be, then it will be. So again, just reiterating her acceptance of everything that she went through. And the last stanza in this says, I'm still praying for that house in Nebraska, by the highway, out on the edge of town, dancing with the windows open. I can't let go when something's broken. It's all I know, and it's all I want now. So even in death, she still is sad. She's still looking back on this love of her life that she lost, and she is still looking back on the life that she could have led if she maybe had been born into different circumstances, if she maybe had healed from her trauma. And that line just like, oh my God, it makes me want to cry. So anyways, the final song, this is my second favorite song on the album, and it also makes me cry. So this song is called Strangers, and this is when we learn that Isaiah is keeping her in a freezer and cannibalizing her. Anyways, so cannibalism has...
So my mic just fucking broke, and I don't feel like finishing this later because I'm almost done talking, and I'm gonna keep holding this because it's a comfort thing for me, so I apologize for the audio in this, but this show must go on. We're almost done. So cannibalism has been used in a lot of literature and film as a kind of metaphor for love. Have you ever been so in love with someone that you just like literally want to crawl into their skin? Is that creepy? Is that something that I just think of? I don't know. But I definitely experienced this with my current boyfriend. I just feel like I'm so in love with him that I just like literally want to live in his stomach. So if you don't get what I mean, then that's fine. Don't worry about it. But yeah, I think cannibalism as like a metaphor for love is very interesting and very beautiful. But obviously in this scenario, we know that abuse cannot exist with love. And so I think that she is kind of using cannibalism in this sense to talk about how even in death, her body was not her own. Growing up, it wasn't her own. And as I mentioned, in death, it is not her own. She has no control over what happens to her. And oh my God, I don't even want to. Okay, we're not even going to go there. But anyways, it says, in your basement, I grow cold, thinking back to what I was always told. Don't talk to strangers or you might fall in love. Freezer bride, you're sweet divine. You devour like smoked bovine hide. How funny, I never considered myself tough. You're so handsome, walking over to me now. I tried to be good. Am I no good? With my memory restricted to a Polaroid in evidence. I just want to be yours. Can I be yours? Can I be yours? Just tell me I'm yours. If I'm turning in your stomach and I'm making you feel sick, you're so handsome when I'm all over your mouth. Am I making you feel sick? I never blamed you for loving me the way you did. And then it ends with her saying, Mama, just know that I love you and I'll see you when you get here. So I think the lyrics here kind of speak for themselves. But even as she is literally being cannibalized by this man, she is still in love with him to a sense, because she is asking if her remains in his stomach are making him feel sick. Just again, even after everything this man has put this woman through, she is still putting his needs above her own. I think it's interesting too that she mentions her mother in this last line, but not her father. So that leads me to believe that she has been able to completely write off her father. Forgive him, but again, don't forget, and we don't have to see him again or mention him again or ever talk to him again. But she always talks about her mom in like a very sweet light. I think it's also mentioned in the song that she's worried that her mom is going to find her on a milk carton because she didn't tell her mother where she was going. So she's also worried about this man getting sick from eating her, which is a whole thing. But she's worried about her mom, and she just wants her to know that she loves her and that she'll see her. Why can't I say it? She just wants her mom to know that she loves her and that she'll see her soon. And that just, oh my God. Oh. I hope you enjoyed my analysis of Ethel's Cain's preacher's daughter. I hope that it destroyed you as much as it destroyed me. I hope I made sense while I was talking about this. This album makes me extremely emotional and angry, and oh my God, stop crying. No, I'm not gonna stop crying. I'm not gonna apologize for my feelings. No. But this album is really important to me. I think that I tend to project my traumas and a lot of the shit that I have been through onto pieces of art. And this was a particular piece of art that really allowed me to process and heal the last bit of my religious trauma. That is something I've been working on healing for a very, very long time. And I think it's going to be like a lifetime thing. Like, healing is not linear, babe. It is happening constantly. But I just think that the world isn't ready, as Brittany said, for art like this. And I don't think that people understand that things like film, television shows, even music, albums, and pieces of artwork can be tools for healing. And that's why I think it is so important for everyone to create. Like, it doesn't matter if you don't think what you have to say is important. Like, I guarantee you Hayden and Hedonia may have had her doubts, but I know that this album has, oh God, it has helped me. It has helped a lot of my friends. It has helped Brittany Broski. And there is a lot of other pieces of work like this, not just music. Music means a lot to me. And has gotten me through a lot of shit. Yeah, besties, sorry for crying so much. No, I'm not sorry, but I hope that you enjoyed this episode. I am sorry that the audio sounds like shit right now, but I will get this fixed by the next episode, I promise. Thank you so much for tuning in, as always. I really appreciate you. Please take care of yourself. Like, go watch something happy after this, because that was a lot. I know I'm gonna go watch like Arrested Development or something. I don't fucking know. I'm sad now. So thank you to Ethel Cain for helping us feel and process our emotions. And thank you to you for listening to me. You can find this episode on Spotify as well as all other podcasting platforms. I would appreciate if you could subscribe, like, comment, follow, share, whatever you can do. Everything is helpful, any interaction. So I appreciate you as always, and I hope that you have a good rest of your day. And I love you so much. Okay, bye.